with letters.
You know, these banks put it up there.
Send it up to my office, let them read it. And they have a letter, and make sure you read the one I wrote to them. There's no epistle to the Laodicea, it's in the New Testament, is it? That's the dictionary. So what he did was,
remember that he had three letters with him?
He had Philemon, his personal note. He had what we call Colossians, to the church at Colossae. But he had this circular letter, which was to be read to all the churches, to the seven churches in Asia, the seven cities in Asia. But, because of the slave law, apparently, Paul says to Onesimus, the slave, it'd be best if you did not go to Ephesus, which would be the main, if you were going to Colossae, you would land at Ephesus, the main seaport town, which is the logical way to go. The problem was there were always slave patrols out at Ephesus. It's like the chances of being caught were exceedingly high. So Paul tells him, probably, when you go, you go through Laodicea. The chances of being caught, much less. So, because if he was caught before he got home, he'd be put to death. It would be very serious trouble. So he sent him. So he lands in Laodicea, or he starts out, he lands probably, anyway, he starts and goes to Laodicea first. He leaves off this circular letter. He goes on to Colossae down the road and gives them what we call Colossians and the first letter to Philemon, who is Colossae. And they're told to change what they would do. So the circular letter, they would make copies of it and send the original on, because the town next time they want the original too. And so this letter was read in Laodicea and sent all around and ended up in Ephesus. Now, if he had been a slave on the run, he would have started in Ephesus, ended up in Laodicea. What they would do is, Paul probably wrote this document, and he wrote across the top of this, or the original, all the churches that were to read it. But the Laodicea, so he knew what he had told Onesimus, so he wrote Laodicea first. See, you go there, don't go through Ephesus. So they read it, sent a copy of Colossae. So they would make a copy of it, they would read it, make a copy of it, and cross off their name. They had it. Then the original on. To the next church. They would read it, copy it, cross off their name, send the original on. And where did the original end up? Since it went backwards.
Ephesus.
At Ephesus. So as this document came down to the church, the only name that remained on the top of it was Ephesus, where the original ended up. You see what I'm saying? But so it was written the same for Ephesus, Ephesians, and it certainly was written to the Ephesians, the proper name for it. It was written to all these seven churches in Asia. But as I say, it went the other way around. In other words, and Revelation starts at Ephesus, works around to Laodicea. Ephesians starts in Laodicea, goes the other way around in Ephesus. That's why I'm saying, because of the slave law, Onesimus had to go through Laodicea, not Ephesus. The letter started there because he didn't want to get caught. That's why the letter, the slave law, is the reason why the letter is called Ephesians. Right? Did y'all follow that? Yeah.
I think
it's not crazy. I don't know. They would probably have to prove that I imagine the cost of the burden of proof would be up on them to prove who they were and what they were doing there. See, they haven't carried letters with them. The slave traveled, he would have to carry letters with him from his master. If he had no letters, he would be considered a fugitive.
But there was a lot of people roaming around. If I had no letters, did they stop everybody?
No, they didn't. That's why I say. He may have got to Ephesus, you see, and not been caught. But the chances of being caught in Laodicea were much less than if he went to Ephesus.
How do you know that an Ephesus
carried
letters?
We don't. We just use it. Well, we know that whoever carried the Colossian letter also carried the Ephesian letter. Because he says in the Colossian, when you read this, there's no letter to be left off here. They ought to see it. Make sure they read yours and read theirs. And we said this letter is better than Laodicea, and that's what we call Ephesian.
Why did he say the letter left off in Laodicea?
Because what Onesimus did was, and that's what they'd be able to say, that's off that letter, went down the road to Colossae.
Look at the top
there. Yeah. So they left off on the way. Did y'all see that? Well, there's an instance where the knowledge of the ancient world helps us to, this minor, this may be different, it's a minor point, but I think it's interesting. It helps it come alive, doesn't it? Here you see this poor fella, you know, sneaking through the house in the wee hours, knocking on the door of the elder chairman board. Saying, here's the letter, I gotta go ahead for trying to get home before I got caught. Okay. Well, anyway, so we had slaves running away, and Onesimus was one of these. Slavery was a real problem to the ancients, as it always is to the owners. They live in the... It's interesting. Many historians and sociologists are writing now and saying that one of the greatest tragedies of American slavery, one of the greatest tragedies, was not what it did to the black man, but what it did to the white man. What it made out of him. The kind of society he had. There was the kind of society that the white man had to create in the South to maintain slavery was made something that was almost as bad for him in other ways as it was for the black man. And it's a great tragedy for everybody concerned. The stories. Oh, about let me back up again. By law, where did the slave stand under the law? Interestingly enough, a slave was considered a race. This is a legal R-E-S. This is a legal term. Still said. It means the Latin word for a thing. A slave was a thing under the law. However, in religious matters, or in case of an oath, he was considered a persona. Interesting, and I guess interesting, you need real ambiguity here. That is, if you wanted to buy him and sell him, he was a thing. You got that? He was a piece of chattel. But, in religious matters, as far as his relationship with the gods, he was a person. And, you got that? Or he had an immortal soul, if you believe in that, in the ancient world. And, if he made an oath, it was binding. Therefore, finally, he entered into a contract, signed his name on the dotted line, as it were, then he was a person. It was binding. See, isn't this ambiguous? I mean, if he was just a thing, his word would be nothing. But he was, you got that? As far as his ownership, in all of law, he was a thing, except in religion and in matters of an oath. And by the way, these two are kind of tied together because the oaths were religious matters. So his word is as if he were a man. In other words, they made him a thing where they wanted him to be a thing, and a man where they wanted him to be a man. It was convenient. And again, you see, we see this in American slavery. The real problem that the white man had was, is my slave a thing or a person? Especially if he was a Christian or considered himself a Christian. If the slave were a Christian, does he have a soul? You see. Now many said yes. And they would create, they try to teach religion to their slaves. Many said no. The theory of evolution in the 19th century was warped, taken out of proportion, and used to support the fact that the black man was a man, but he was farther down the evolutionary scale. Therefore, he was not quite a man. He was on the way to becoming a man, but he was not a man. Dave?
Was there a law against abusing or murdering slaves by the owners?
No. In that way, there was a thing. If you wanted to kill him, you could. He was just like a dog. Very good question, yes.
Are you part of that? Some of that attitude prevalent today that you've heard about J.B. Stoner, haven't you?
I don't know if I have another, but there we go.
He's a friend. In politics in the South, he used to circulate a paper called The Thunderbolt. And he'd give diagrams of skulls and all, and he was trying to prove that blacks didn't have a soul, they were just animals.
Yeah, a little bit more. Well, for instance, this is a term, what was it? The term mongoloid for a child has been replaced with what, Ryan syndrome, or?
No.
What is it?
Down.
Yes. The reason is that this came, the old theory was that the yellow man was just barely a man. The Mongolian, the black man was slightly above, the white man was right. And that in certain birds there would be an evolutionary throwback. Therefore, this child was born with this deficiency. Their eyes look almost oriental. Therefore, they concluded this was an evolutionary throwback back to the Mongolian period of evolution, hence a Mongoloid child. So that term came from. And the blackness was an evolutionary throwback, therefore he was on his way to becoming a man. Then there were a clear definition of all kinds of ideas floating around. But then I'm simply saying, I don't want to spend too much time, I'm simply saying that in America, the slave owners have always had this problem, and Americans have this. What is he? He's a man, you know, can I ethically own him? Treat him like a thing. But if he's a thing, why does he look so much like a man? Why does he think and dream and sing and pray? If he did the thing. And they developed, and you still have this today, they developed the theory that the black man inherently was inferior. He was born with a diminished capacity to learn or to think or to feel. And so the white man in the South, white slave owner, convinced himself, generally speaking, most of them did, that he doesn't really, when he's laughing, he doesn't really know joy, not real joy, not some way I do. When he hurts, doesn't really hurt. When you take one of his children away, it's not quite the same as taking one of mine away. It's kind of like taking the pups away from another dog. And by the way, you saw this in Roots, in this discussion. This was brought out very quite accurately. And so, they resolved it in their minds in various ways, but I don't want to go into that on the first of this class. I want to simply point out that the ancient world had the same problem. Is he a man or is he not a man? And so this is how they resolved it. He was a man. If you wanted to kill him, he was a thing. But if you wanted to sign a contract with him, he was a... And by the way, interestingly enough, in courts of law, if a slave took an oath, his word was accepted as a man. Not against his own master. A slave cannot testify against his own master. But, you know, if he's brought in as a witness and took an oath, then you have to accept his testimony. Now, the next day, you don't have to take him out and kill him. And he have no legal complications or responsibilities. So it's really, you say, well, it doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't make any sense. That's where you stood. Question?
I was just thinking it would be harder for
people in the Roman Empire to rationalize that in their mind, because he could very easily see a brother or if it was prisoner of war or debtor or whatever, so it could be harder than
the...
Very difficult. Yeah, but
they're all the
same color. And by the way, one more thing, if you were a slave of a person, if he put a curse on you, you were in trouble. That is, it was the same as the other person. His curses were efficacious. He gave an evil eye, he could be the end. I took. And so in that way, he was a person. Okay, we'll take this. So, have a good weekend. To finish up very quickly our discussion of slavery. Everyone has an outline, don't you? Okay, we're on Roman numeral 4, background of slavery, source of slave. I gave you those. A couple more. And this is important. I was saying, should have been saying, the last hour, that slavery is an important consideration in the background of New Testament studies for any number of reasons. We mentioned the most famous slave in the New Testament, Onesimus, which is the runaway slave. I mentioned Philemon. I told you why. Okay. Roundabout logic, why the fact of slave laws explained probably, and underline the word probably, why the book of Ephesians was named that, because unless the one was going home and stopped by down the normal way, he would have been up in the Laodiceans, and would have been called the Laodiceans. You don't get that argument? I see, I don't really put bread and butter on the table, you know. But anyway, it's important because of the New Testament doctrine on slaves,
where Paul says to slaves, treat your masters as Christ taught, as Christ treated those who claimed authority over him, and the masters were treat their slaves as brothers. And this is not a theological class. Let me simply say this: you eventually hear this if you get academic students very much. The New Testament is morally or ethically unworthy because the Apostle Paul, for instance, who had opportunity to condemn the institution of slavery, did not do so. To point out that the institution of slavery was in the very warp and woof of the ancient world. Secondly, Christianity did, by implication, destroy slavery in Western Europe. There would be no theological reason for Christianity, for Paul, for instance, to attack an institution of slavery. He does speak very strongly to the way of a master to treat a slave. But I think you ought to know, if you don't already know, that the New Testament does not teach the doctrine of civil rights. The New Testament does not teach the doctrine of rights at all. The idea of civil rights is not a Christian doctrine, but a biblical doctrine. Now, the liberal Christianity often finds itself in the forefront of the belief of the demand of civil rights. Now, while a Christian is going to go by what we call the golden rule, listen very closely. If a Christian is going to go by what we call the golden rule, then he will extend rights, and even more than rights to other people, right? He will give them. And Paul does call upon the slave owners, take the hat off, to do this. I doubt you can concentrate that hat on. And Paul does this by saying to the slave owners, you must treat this as treat the slave as your brother. However, the doctrine of in this area, the doctrine of the new time in the New Testament in Christianity is the doctrine of grace, not rights. The Bible teaches that no Christian has any right to claim. We can give them, but we cannot claim them. That is, the one thing we do not want is what we've earned. You know, we do not want what we have a right to. For instance, in Romans 14, Paul discusses the fact that the stronger brother must not say, well, I have a right to eat anything I want to, no matter how my weaker brother feels about it. We have a right to do that. You see, the only right that we have is the right to go to hell. That's what we've earned. Wages of sin, death. That's what a Christian is not in the business of claiming rights. We're in the grace business. We're in the business of claiming, working by grace, giving it and receiving it. Very bad mistake, by the way, in all human relationships, to treat other people in some other way than you expect God to treat you. How many of you want to come before God on the judgment day and get your rights? I mean, the judgment, do you want that you have a right to? You do, you go to hell. Therefore, we ought. Christianity is not, you got this. Therefore, I'll leave this. And some people say that the doctrine of the claiming of human rights, the doctrine of the claiming of human rights, is not Christianity. Well, so I would be very surprised that if we saw, if we had a doctrine, say, in 2 Corinthians, that condemned institutional slavery in and of itself, I would understand it would not fit in with New Testament theology. This is what we saw. Just like if I read in the book of Romans a commandment to tithe, I would understand it. It would not fit in with the doctrine of love and grace and what you do find. But I think it would not fit in with what you read. Okay. Any questions on that? You all get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Therefore, do not be surprised, you know, that you see, the ethic found in the New Testament is not a lesser ethic, because The institution of slavery is not condemned. It's a higher ethic for that reason. You say to a man, you're a slave. The institution of slavery is inherently immoral, therefore you should revolt. You should refuse to be a slave. You should fight to death. Is that a higher ethic than saying to a man, even though you're a slave, you're going to, because God gives you the benefit of the doubt, you're going to give your master the benefit of the doubt. Because the Son of Man came not to minister to, not to be ministered to, but to what? To minister. The Son of Man came not to make slaves, but to be a servant, to be a slave. For that reason, if you follow that ethic, which is the higher ethic? Well, anyway. Another reason why slavery is important in the New Testament studies is this, that you have the use of slavery as a metaphor and a simile, as illustration. That is, Paul, for instance, presents himself as a doulos, a servant of Jesus Christ. And the concept of servanthood in the New Testament is often spoken of, the metaphor of slavery is often used to illustrate it and or to explain Christian servanthood. Also, I'll give you another example where a slave, with an institution of slavery, the knowledge of it is important in New Testament studies, is in the fact that many slaves, especially in wealthier households, were what are called one-job slaves. In wealthier households, were slaves whose only job was to prepare the bathwater. Some job slaves would serve food, other slaves, their job was in the kitchen. But many one-job slaves, they only did. And imagine a household that had several hundred slaves. The son of wealth, he's seen, but he's had a pretty good life as far as that aspect is concerned. And you have this used as a metaphor in the book of Galatians, for instance, where Paul says that the law was our, the King James says, tutor to bring us to Christ. Well, that's not a good translation. Tutor means teacher. It's not what the law did. Not what the slave did. This Greek word I'm going to use indicates this one job slave. And what this slave would do is often be an older slave, usually a man, who would escort the upper class child, escort the child to school, sit with them, make sure that they were learning what they were supposed to learn, take them home, make sure they got home safely, and make sure that they did their homework. They were not the teacher. They were the escort, the school bus. They were sort of a teacher's aide. And that was a one-job slave. That was his job. They just came to school, sit with them, help them with their homework, make sure they got back and forth safely. And that's what the law did, bringing us to Christ. But there's an example where you have to understand the institution of slavery as it existed in the first century, to understand the metaphor. That means how the law comes in. I don't remember that. Okay? Now, we know that slaves, they're common to have slaves in the church. Romans 16, I won't go into the names, many of these, which contain a long list of personal names. Many of these were common slave names. And so many of the early Christians were slaves, lived slaves and died slaves. Do you have any questions on that? I pointed out, by the way, that's all. Any questions on slavery? Yes.
How would you know what was a common slave name and what wasn't?
From what record? From other classical sources. You can tell a Jewish name, a Greek name, because you know that Timotheus, for Peter, that's a Greek name, and Simon is a Jewish name. And certain names are Roman names, Roman aristocratic names, and certain names were reserved for slaves. They would not be given family names.
So So if you read a lot, you
Yeah, it is. Traveling into it, you have to consider much material. You see, you compare them with the classical sources. As we approach the subject of freedmen, which is a subfund of the thing of slavery, I pointed out already that many slaves became free. In fact, so many slaves became free that there developed a whole class of people in the Augustan world who were ex-slaves. Now, I pointed out that Augustus passed a law forbidding owners to free a slave and make them a ward of the state once they were too sick or too old to work. But beyond that, it was a very common thing for slaves to become freedmen. Now, there was a certain onus attached to them. There was a certain civil disability attached to them. They were always ex-slaves. They never got rid of that taint, if you want to call it that. However, I pointed out that many slaves were, just as you had very bad slavery, such as the mines or the galleys, you had slaves who, in effect, became members of the family. By the way, this is one thing you never really had in American slavery. For one thing, you did not have in every occasion, some of it, it was very common in the Roman slavery, ancient slavery, not just Romans, for the slave to be of the same, quote, race as the master. And if it's someone to death, you see, there was no racial difference in many cases. And which you did have in American slavery, of course. Often these slaves would become, in effect, members of the family. They would become trusted and loved. And it was very, very common for a master to reward a slave by setting him free. Often they would say to the slave, look, if you'll be faithful to me, if you'll be the kind of slave I can trust, you handle my affairs in a worthy manner, then in my will, I will free you and your family. So it was very common for slaves to become free when their master died. And masters often held this out as an incentive. When you figure that a man who was 40 years old was an old man, on the average, on the actuary scales that they have, very common for a man to die suddenly, what we would call a young age. And this was pretty, this was not, you say, well, I'll live 40 years, and then, you look good for like you wouldn't live 40 years. And so, also, many slaves, and by the way, and many masters simply freed their slaves. And the slave continued as an employee, because they genuinely loved them, concerned about them. And, There was this genuine brotherhood. Part of this thing of freeing slaves came because the Romans, and I'm going to come back to this again, but mention it briefly here. The Romans did not write their own philosophies or their great literature or their plays. They borrowed from the Greeks, The philosophy that the Romans borrowed primarily was Stoicism. It was the Stoics who taught the doctrine of the brotherhood of all men. So the heavy influence of Stoicism would lead to the freeing of slaves. Now, again, you do not find a parallel to this in American slavery, because you often had the white slave owner would express love for the slave, a little affection, and yet it was always a patronizing affection, as much as the white slave owner would love to be concerned about the black slave. It was always the love of a client for a patron, perhaps of a father to a child, but not really. That is, it was always the love of a superior to an inferior. It was never genuine brotherhood. It was never a time when the white slave owner or the white man, in many cases, would ever consider the black slave to be his equal. He might say, well, for instance, and you find leftovers of this in our culture. It's not just in the South, it's all over the country. You find just as much in the North as in the South. Say, well, some of my best friends are black. Now that simply is a lie. It's not true. So, and you often know, a white man will say, well, I'm not prejudiced. Anybody says he's not prejudiced, you better run and hide. It gets you some other way. Because we're all prejudiced. If we're Christians, we're trying to get over it. We're not just against race, we're prejudiced. All kinds of economically prejudiced, and educationally prejudiced, and sexually prejudiced. We're all prejudiced. Yes, we are. You are, and I am. And but anyway, just because this white man, friends will say, well, I'm not prejudiced. He'll continue to tell you how he works with black people every day, and he's loaned them money, and taking care of them sometimes. And that's, you know, there's always the inferior, the superior dealing with the inferior. It's always the patronizing kind of friendship. I bet they'll tell me, well, yeah, I'm not prejudiced. I work in London, but my best friends are black. Oh, this is your best friend, huh? Yeah. Work with them every day. You have more stuff.
Well, some of them are married.
Pardon?
Some of them are married, too.
Yeah. Or, you go fishing. You think you want to run a fishing buddy? Yeah. Well, there's all of them. Fishing, you know.
Pond up and ask him to go and watch football game with you on Sunday afternoon.
But what you mean is I tolerate him at work, you know, we do a lot of time. As long as he realizes that I'm the superior, he's the inferior. As soon as he forgets that, then he's uppity. And so you don't, and yet it's still in our culture, by the way. For instance, they would say, why do you loan them money? How would you borrow them? Go to them for advice. But would you really an equal? And so you did not have this American slavery. You don't have very little of it. And I'll give you an example of the some of my best friends were black. Oh man, we ask you this, have you ever said that? Have you ever stayed all night in a black home? Did you go there and spend the night? Mm-hmm. You ever, how many of you have been?
Three. Yeah. My father used to go to St. Thomas and I spend weekends over there, and he'd have to stay in a black home.
In the Virgin Islands? Now, how about America, though?
That's where the whole island is all black. They all have the shacks, you know.
Also, as I put out before, many
freedom. So I said, some slaves didn't belong to him so often they owned slaves. And the slaves often would have the incentive. For instance, the common sense, here's a man, he's got a number of slaves, and often it would be Greek slaves, especially more educated slaves. He would say to a man making a CPA, or you know, we call it just business manager, and he would say to him, look, make a deal with you. You conduct business well, and you get profits on the estate, and or on business, and you can keep 8%. 8% is yours. Or 15% is yours, or whatever, and decide on it. And the man would be, say, this would be, this would help everybody. He would be encouraged. He would make a good profit for his master. And he could save it. And often they would simply buy their own freedom. By themselves. Now they would continue as a client of their master. But you see, free citizens, I wish I had time to witness, but in Rome, free citizens who had never been slaves also had clients. There was the old aristocracy at the top, then the free mass, the mob under them. These mob always had a client relationship. They had remember the aristocracy that they depended upon. For instance, if you wanted to have a case heard in court, you had to be sponsored by this client. And he would represent you in certain civil matters. And so the slave would continue as the client of his patron. But that in itself was not demeaning, because free citizens had clients too. I mean, had patrons too. They all did. Now there was a prejudice. They continued prejudice against slaves. As I said, this thing of a master. You misunderstand me. This thing of a master really considering the slave an equal and freeing him therefore did not happen most of the time. Most of the time didn't happen that way. But it did happen often. Now. The real problem in Rome, the real prejudice against slaves, because many of these slaves, while they were still slaves, were better off than the mobs who were free. For one reason, they would work and many of the mob wouldn't work. And by the way, you see this developing in South Florida. Not exactly this, but you see something like this. You also saw it, you see it in every time in our country in the last 75, 80 years since we became a welfare state, you find an influx of immigrants. They often will take the jobs, the menial jobs, that the American citizen won't take. Hospital orderlies, janitors, cooks, dishwashers. And what you often find, and you see this in South Florida some, I'm sure, I don't mind guessing, I'm not from there, anytime you can tell me. I know it happened in New York with the Irish immigrants, it happened with the Italian immigrants, it happened with the German immigrants, it happened in the Orient with the Oriental, it happened in the West Coast with the Oriental immigrants, it happened in Texas, in Oklahoma with the Mexican immigrants. So it's happened in every situation where you have the quote citizen who's above, you know, working as a menial, you know, for being a household servant or garbage man or anything. Well, you've been a garbage man a lot more than I do, but you know, the bus boys, these menial jobs, they will. Often you have many Americans who will not do these jobs. They'll take welfare first. But they make just about as much on welfare. They will not. They're too good to take these jobs. It's demeaning. And so what happens? Well, you get, because of a number of reasons, not political situations in other countries, you get an influx of immigrants who will take these jobs. What happens in one generation? Well, you maybe every member of the family works, these immigrants. Here's what they do. They come in, and there's a matter of survival. And these jobs don't look bad to them. The wages look spectacular compared to where they came from. They're glad to get them. Every member of the family works. And they work hard. And they want to become Americans. So what do they do? They prosper. And they send their children to college. And they become, the second generation becomes lawyers and doctors. And there's a great deal of animosity and bitterness and jealousy within one generation. and the older citizen who would not work, and all of a sudden he's still on welfare. He's still on welfare, his children are on welfare, and what's happening to immigrants who couldn't even speak the English language? They moved uptown. Why? They would work. They made something of themselves. It's happening in Miami, I understand, with the Cubans now. But it's happened. It's happened everywhere. And so there's a real animosity against these foreigners coming in and taking our jobs. How'd this guy get that good job? Well, he went to the employer and he asked for it, and the employer looked at his record and saw that he had stated, you know, he was a good worker. The reason you didn't get it is because you went in and you announced that you would take it. You would do the guy a great privilege to take his job. You get honored, you know, do him a favor and take his job as long as you got three times as much as he was offering. And won't get to work 35 hours a week and 2 hour coffee breaks. So why should he do it? He hired the other guy. That's how he got the job. He would do it. He would work at it. Well, this thing, and so this creates animosity. And didn't Rome, and in the major cities of the Roman Empire, you had many free citizens who were on welfare, who were uneducated, living from hand to mouth, and they would walk down the street and see slaves, who were still slaves, always would be slaves, who were well off, skilled, sometimes educated, and better dressed. And it became a great point of contention. And these freedmen, these freed slaves, this class of freedmen, by the way, King James called them, we had a whole synagogue of them, mentioned in the book of Acts, called the Synagogue of the Libertine. It's an unfortunate translation. Libertine means, a playboy. But now, not when that word was translated, it's simply freedmen. There's a whole synagogue of Jewish freedmen. They were a class by themselves. They stuck together. They tended to be better off. They tended to be wealthier. They tended to be better educated, higher class people, we would call them, because that's how they got free, by being loved, respected, or financially successful. So a very interesting class. And you find them mentioned again. Why am I spending time on this? Because you run into these freedmen in the New Testament very often. Now, any questions on that? That's about all the time I have. About that, yes, okay.
The slaves that were free, did they have the same rights as any Roman citizens?
No, not quite. They had some civil disabilities. That's what they didn't vote. But America, most Roman citizens couldn't vote either because of a property requirement. If they had
the
property requirement, they couldn't vote. Got that?
Did the women have the same rights as the men?
It roughly corresponds to the free citizen. The answer is no. A woman had certain rights, but not as many rights as the men. Other questions?
Didn't I read somewhere last week or so that there was a tax on slaves also?
Yes.
Was that the intended to free them?
See, slavery is a very expensive business. But that was not an incentive to free them. That was an incentive to sell them. Yes.
Are you saying
that slaves come on slaves?
So the property that
slaves
can make
belongs
to the owner?
Yes. Well, yes. If not, well, it depends on the owner. He wanted to claim that he could. But you see, these men, you see, many of these Romans, you see, you can't stereotype. You can picture a slave owner as being harsh, man, with a whip in his hand, no sign of a greed. Many were like that. We weren't. First, we had the centurion, New Testament, who was so concerned about his fucking slave that he made a long trip to see Jesus to get help from him. He left. He was there. So there's everything from the worst kind of slavery to this kind where he would be so honored and respected and equally to set him free. Yes.
Back in the room today, where did a good slave stand in relation to a woman?
I don't know. Depends.
talking about a citizen, and he would have fewer civil rights. However, as far as actually, again, you see, when it comes to money, we're the one class. Those who've got it, that really count. And for the slave that became proficient, that became that paid, they could make money for someone else, whether by their owner or by trading with someone else, they tended to do business with them. So it was very common to find
somebody who's a copy who's a member of the somebody like the Jews who are not own citizens for the most part. And question which country it was. Very complicated.
Servile was a talent for the king.
No, that was a steward, not a slave. The difference. A steward and a slave. Steward was not a slave necessarily, probably not. He was like a sharecropper or no more than that business agent. Employee. By the way, one more word about the freedmen. In 140 and 154, the second century, it's after our period, this is the joint of this Baptist history and entertainment. One of the leading leaders in the church, a man that became Bishop of Rome, was a man who had been a slave, was a freedman. So the freedmen were kind of a class over their own, kind of upper class economically, the lower class civilly. They could not vote like a free citizen, for instance. And there were some marriage restrictions, too. The law forbade them to marry with the aristocratic family. Some marriage restrictions, voting restrictions. But economically, they were pretty well off. Yes.
Was it possible for them to buy into a citizenship in Rome?
Yes, you could buy a citizenship in Rome. This is not the empire theory. Although, and of course they did. Anybody else? Yes.
Did any of the slaves own slaves themselves?
Yes. That's unusual, but it was not unheard of.
Why did they have a problem with
that? Y'all did.
I guess a lot of the slaves liked slavery, huh?
Well, some, if they were born, they never knew anything else. But generally, they were not happy. There was this thing, this ideal situation. They were into wealth, they were against free. That was not the majority. I thought you were talking about Spartacus to be old. Generally, there was not. There were overall, there was this slave were not happy to be slaves. Now, as far as investment, things like that, you see, one thing that really curtailed that was the fact that the master had the right to capital punishment. There was the master wanted to take a slave out and hang him up. You know, there's limb on a moment's notice, if they were right to do so, often they did. The slave had no civil liberty, civil protection. Although, that's one thing that you say, if you were a slave, you were a piece of property. I had this thing on the board for the law, you know, there were certain things, you were a piece of property. Okay. Let's leave, I spent all the time I want to spend on slavery. Let's move down now to Roman religion. First of all, I would talk about the traditional mythological religions. Now, let me give you something you had in other classes, but I think you get the general picture of the ancient world. In the ancient world, the ancient Romans, back in the days of the Republic, before our period, the ancient pure old Roman stock were a people called Etruscans, E-T-R-U-S-C-A-N-S, Etruscans. And they had the normal animistic kind of gods, but what the ancient peoples did, this is a lesson in all of ancient history. The ancient peoples they were polytheistic, which means, of course, polytheism. Many gods. And they practiced this thing of identifying gods with real estate. That is, if you went
from Egypt to Babylon, you went under the turf of other gods. You should recognize those gods. That's step number one, if you want to put it down like that. You got that? They tended to give gods geographically. Didn't mean your God didn't exist or weren't present. It meant that your gods were not in charge in the land. Now, the God of Israel, the gods of Canaan, the gods of Egypt. As there was more and more social intercourse, and as they began to know one another, to travel, to intermarry, as they developed, especially this was speeded up, of course, by the onset of the Hellenistic period, the conquest of Alexander the Great, as there developed a genuine cosmopolitan spirit, cosmos, world, polis, city, and the world is one city, underlying unity of people. What the peoples did was, rather than the next step from viewing gods as territorial gods, the next step was to identify your gods with the gods of your neighbor, and by simply giving the gods more than one name. For instance, to identify the god that the people of the next country worship with the god that you worship. Now you see this. For instance, some of the ancient Mesopotamian gods. Ishtar was simply renamed and claimed by the people of the West. The clearest example of this, and the Greeks and the Romans did this, but I want us to see the point I'm making here is that the Greeks and the Romans were not the only ones who did this. It was a common practice. You got this? And Herodotus, for Greek Herodotus, he'll tell you. Now the Egyptians worship this goddess, and we think it's the same goddess that we've always had. This corresponds to our goddess, maybe often, but the same name. But the Greeks and Romans did this wholesale. For instance, you have Zeus is the Greek name for Jupiter. They simply traded names, or made the names interchangeable. And they did this many gods. For instance, we have this in the New Testament. Diana, goddess of the Ephesians, great as Diana. What's her Greek name? Artemis. Mercury is Hermes. But I'm going to spend much time on these gods, because by the Augustan period, the old mythology, the old gods, were as a genuine social or philosophical theological force, were pretty much passe. They were done. They were not taken seriously. As I've said before, the average Greco-Roman god was a cross between Superman and the Seven Dwarfs. they were like Superman, Mount Olympus, Zeus or Jupiter. But what they were, this made them different from the people of the ancient East. Ancient East, their gods were fearsome things. They were pictured in unreal ways. They were often, pictured as souped-up animals, lions with wings. This is about an imagery in the Book of Daniel, for instance. They would be horrible, gargoyle-type figures, fearsome. But not so with the Greeks and the Romans, who brought it from the Greeks, adapted the Greek theological thinking. Their gods were simply souped-up men. Everything was souped up. Physically, you have Atlas, that holds up the world, and Hercules, but their immoralities were souped up as well. They regularly argued, killed each other, committed adultery, raped each other, and humans with some regularity. One of the greatest statues of Hermes shows him, I'm sorry, Hercules shows him dead drunk. The gods of the Greeks and Romans, if you took them at face value, they would not, you might be afraid of them. You might try to placate them. The one thing you would not do is fall on your face in holy awe before them and love them. You might take them down, to the corner bar and offer to buy them a beer, but you wouldn't. You did not respect or love these gods. You feared them. They were simply mankind at his worst. They were, and by the figurines of these people are human figures. They're simply, as one author has put it, that in the book of Genesis we find that God made man for his own image. And the Greeks reversed that, and they made their gods after their image. And they often confuse in their thinking the gods with the heroes. For instance, many of their gods had been men. Who had been, they had a term called, or what we call, apotheosis. The apotheosis is simply to become a god, to be made a god. Now, these gods were silly, cruel, unpredictable. The whole system was intellectually feeble. And while these gods would serve a narrow world, a parochial world, the world of the village, when the world expanded, you got there? When men began to think of terms, when they knew who lived beyond the next mountain, and when they had traveled, for instance, this is one of the things you see this phenomenon in American culture, or in all cultures. This is one of the results of war. You get to take the boy off the farm. In fact, there's a song about it. How are you going to keep him down the farm after what? After they've seen Paris. Take the boys off the farm, and you take them, and they see Europe. They travel, they see other worlds, they hear other ideas. They're never the same. Sometimes it's to the good, sometimes it's to the bad, they're never the same. And you see, with the Greeks and the Romans, when they marched through the world and heard the stories of other nations and saw what other nations had done, saw the ancient cities, heard the ancient myths, met the ancient gods. As man's mind grew bigger, then these silly little local warring, petty, murderous, immoral, lecherous gods simply would not do. Therefore, but even though they were given a great deal of lip service, and even though in the first century you would find many of the common people back in the smaller villages and the rural areas who would still honor these gods in the cities, these gods were given lip service only. Now, what they would do is they would remember this movie, Charles Laughton played the part of a senator in the movie Spartacus. He was Spartacus. And he was trying to save the Republic. And this was before our period. And Charles Laughton, they had a real trying time in the Senate. They gave him the Senate, walking with him, Julius Caesar. And he buys a bird from a vendor, he's going to buy the temple and offer sacrifice for the fortune of this gentleman who's going to go down, try to go out and put down the revolt, slave revolt. And Julius Caesar says to Charles Laughton, the senator, why are you offering this sacrifice? I thought you didn't believe in the gods. And Charles Laughton remembers this classic line. He says, it's captured the thought of many, not the many, city civilization. He said, Publicly, I believe in all of them. Privately, I believe in none of them. And that was just about it for a minute. So that the old religions were, by the time of Christ, were inadequate. More I want to say about this, but I'll put my time is now. I'll take the question off.
When Paul was before the area,
Yes, good question. Let's stop this up here. Paul, Marcel, you ridiculed the idea. Finishing. He gets up and just lampoons the old God.
You know, not made with hands, homemade gods, handmade gods.
And the Greeks just said, those philosophers just sit there. Their word. Or the things of death. Well, when they talk about the resurrection from the dead, that's what got them. But that did not offend their theology, that offended their philosophy.
We are, we're up to our necks in our discussion on Roman religion, and let me present this to you in a systematic or summary fashion, and we'll discuss these points as we go along. Let me say, first of all, that as we come to the Augustan age, that we do see a revival in mythological religion. Now, I say this because the next, what we're going to talk about when we finish this, we're going to talk about the Roman mystery religions. But they're not the same thing at all as the old traditional mythological, that is the old gods, Zeus, Hermes, Diana or Artemis, and they had gods, and they had what were called heroes or heroids, who were kind of part god, part man, where our term hero comes from. Then they had the lesser gods below that. I don't have time to develop this, it's not really that important, called the Fates. Then they had, under those, they had muses. Like Cleo was the muse of history. You know, a poet will say, oh, my muse is dead, my muse has died. That means I have no inspiration, I can't write poetry. And then there were they had the hours. And so there were a lot of types, there were many gods. And there was so this is what we're talking about when we talk about Roman mythological religion. Now, in the time of Augustus Caesar, there was a revival of the mythological religions. Temples had fallen into disrepair. Priesthoods were vacant. They had abandoned the gods, pretty much. For instance, Suetonius writes about Augustus and his reform movement. He also revived certain obsolescent rites and appointments. The augury of the goddess safety, the office of Flamen Dialis, the priesthood of Jupiter, the Lupercalian festival, the secular games, and the crossroads festival. But at the Lupercalia, he forbade any boys to run who had not yet shaved off their first beards. Well, that's about a third of our student money. And he goes on to talk about how he restored games, he rebuilt temples. But let's understand what's going on. There was, this was on behalf of the state. You see, the common people, how they believe in the gods. The gods had been abandoned, and you recall that I discussed the fact that the dictatorships of Julius Caesar and then of Augustus Caesar rose from the chaos of a disintegrating republic, and anarchy, chaos always produces dictatorships. And what Augustus realized was that he had to have an emotional focal point for the people. And he set out to, as we've already discussed, to restore Rome in terms of the old virtues, almost. He restored the framework, the facade of constitutional government. But who had the real control? He did. He kept everything very tightly in his own hand.
And he said to the people, if Rome is going to reclaim its ancient greatness, it's going to have to go back and honor the gods who made us great. It was a religious revival. You got this? A rebuilding of temples, a reinstitution of the games. Priesthoods were once again supported, created and supported in the temples. However, there are some important qualifications we must place upon this. First, and that is that the faith that the in these gods, as far as Augustus was concerned, was the French have an interesting word. The French have a word called politique, P-O-L-I-T-I-Q-U-E, which means the art of saying what needs to be said or doing what needs to be done, whether you believe it or whether it's right. It's politique. It's expedient. And for Augustus, this was politique. For Cicero, who lived roughly a contemporary of Augustus, he wrote and said, we've got to have a strange marriage. He came and told me, he said he'd be back in a minute. He had to chase his wife home. Oh, run his wife home, sorry. you forgot his book, too.
No. Oh, but I took the movement there.
Now, Cicero had recommended that the people be turned back to religion, because religion is an antidote for chaos. It's an opiate for the people, as Marx would say. Religion is this sort of patronizing view of the aristocracy. Religion is good for the people. It keeps them in line. Ovid, who in his Ars Amora, the art of love, remember I mentioned this before, that he was in favor of love, as long as you have a great romantic relationship with somebody, as long as you weren't married to them. And in his work, The Art of Love, or Ars Amora, he said, quote, "The existence of God is convenient, and as it is convenient, let's assume it." Yeah, the existence, it's convenient to believe in the gods. Therefore, since it is convenient, let's assume they exist. To make you good existentialist. And but now I want you to see, that we do not see with the aristocracy a genuine revival of religious faith. It was, you see that the kind of thing you see in the Middle Ages, in Christendom, in medieval Europe, you see that there was no distinction in the minds of the people between their religion and their state. Therefore, you could not revive the state without reviving the religion. However, again, we tend to think of this from our point of view. We're not talking about a heartfelt repentance and turning toward the gods. In the first place, you do not repent toward gods who were at least as immoral as you were. You did not go back and love them again. What did you do? Well, you went back and you went through the forms, or you reestablished the forms of external worship. You said the prayers. You chanted the chants. You made the sacrifices. You went out and got drunk on their feast days. Now, and so to Augustus and to the aristocracy, this revival of religion was simply a matter of providing an emotional focal point for the masses. Because when they were doing this, rebuilding the temples, reinstituting the feasts and the festivals and the games on behalf of the gods, what they were doing was saying to themselves, this is what makes me a Roman, this is what makes Rome great, the gods who made us great shall make us great again. And this revival was only in terms of the reinstitution of the external forms of worship and celebration. Many of the aristocracies of Cicero and Ovid and Augustus himself did not say that this was not a transition from atheism to faith. You got that? Many of them didn't believe anymore after the revival began than they did before. They simply said, this is a part, this recognition of the gods
this restoration movement to, as far as temple worship is concerned, is a part of our reestablishing the might of ancient Rome, traditions of ancient Rome. This was all part of it. You could never separate the two. Now, what about the common people? Well, you would have a superstitious belief among the common people. By the way, if you're interested in pursuing this, I think the best book available is the book by R. Mogilvie, a very fine historian of this period, The Romans and Their Gods in the Age of Augustus. And he writes, for instance, about how the common people viewed their gods. The chief feature in the Roman religion was the belief that all the important processes in the world were divinely activated and conversant, that different gods had charge of particular functions and spheres of activities. That is, there was a god for everything. Some of the most primitive cults show by their very names how the simple farmers of early Rome were naturally concerned to deify the agricultural operations on which their livelihood depended. Flora, Pomona, which is fruit, Consus, the store, the Robicus, the blight, Ceres, the growth, and so on. There is preserved an ancient list of invocations derived from the manual of the priests, which demonstrates again how the gods were thought of in terms of functions. This god was not thought of in terms of his personality or his love or his might. He was the god who was in charge of blight. If you got blight on your corn, then you had offended this god.
How did info worship fit in with that?
Okay, I'll get to that. That's an excellent question. I'm not going to answer it. I'll tell you in a few minutes. Let me come to that. In this way, I'm excerpting now, in this way, most of the things which were vital for the well-being of society were thought of as functions of a god as God's functioning. A house is only as secure as its door. The opening and closing of the door, and the passage of a man from the privacy of his home into the racket of the outside world and vice versa can be critical events, and in consequence they relate to being the power of a god. Janus. Janus was the god of it both ways. That's why they named the first month of the year after him. Look back to the old year, forward to the new year, January, of course. So he was the god of the goings and comings, looking both ways. Whether the opening and closing resulted in good or evil for the person concerned would therefore depend on Janus' favor, and so forth. This way it was back in the days of the Republic. Some of this was restored. Much of it was restored. And by the way, among the common people, it was a superstitious, ignorant fear of gods and god and demigods. It was not, again, it was not a religion in the sense that we would think of it or speak of it in terms of repentance, of love, kindness, justice, the fear of God, of worship in the sense of falling down in awe before the great and good God. And by the way, this superstition, and when you take my class in early Christian centuries, we'll discuss this somewhat thoroughly. This common Roman superstition of attributing every function in life and every object almost to a god led in the development in the 5th and 6th centuries in Rome, in what came to be what we call Roman Catholicism. This evolved into what is now known as saint worship, where a saint, and you find this in South America and Europe more than you do in America, and in Southern America, but where every aspect of life is overseen by a certain saint. Every day of the year, if you're born on that day, you're often named after that saint. And every function in life, you know, remember, we saw some a few years ago when they used to put St. Christopher on the dashboard. He was in charge of safe journeys. He was the man who carried Jesus across the water on his back.
They abolished
that. Yes, and they decided he never existed, so if you're going to take a journey, you give obeisance to the saint who's in charge of safe journeys. You're going to get married, you get, you know, St. Valentine. Boy, is he been out of his luck. Anyway, so forth. But this, as Roman superstition led to a superstitious expression of so-called Christianity, this thing of this aspect of it resulted in what we in the same thing with us. We'll see if they were superstitious. Okay. Now, however, we need to attach a disclaimer to this as well.
Because just as in the minds of many of them, and by the way, you realize it's very hard to know when a man said, when a man, for instance, the historians, the histories that we have are of this period are from the aristocrats, and often they take the form of speeches. Tacitus has been called the historian of the upper 1,000. And so when you have the recorded speech of a senator or an emperor, it's very difficult to know whether that's what he, how he really feels, or whether that's politique, whether it represents his true sentiments or what he's saying. It's like when a speech an ambassador makes. How funny our culture is getting. You know, when the president gets up and makes a speech, isn't it amazing how nobody even expect anymore, nobody, when President Carter, any president gets up to speak, now nobody even expects there to be a direct connection between what he says and reality. Nobody expects it. And so what they did, well, they get the newscasters who come on after the presidential address and tell you what he really meant, probably. Now, but I think historians generally agree, and I think on good grounds, that among the aristocracy, there's a great deal of skepticism. That is, let's be religious, yeah, it's good for the country. Among the common people, there was a great deal of belief. But again, it was not worship or religion as we would describe it. And even with the common people, and this is very, very important, there was no connection between public and private devotion in their minds. It's a very strange mentality, a lot of Christians like this today. There's no connection, no necessary connection between what you professed in public and what you believed in private. And Mr. Nicholas, you and I were talking about this after class, this is what I meant was, when that there was a general failure to take this thing seriously. And you pointed out that your teachers you had studying mythology before pointed out how these people really followed these things. Well, you see, it's really strange that in a period when there was a rebuilding of temples and reinstitution of priesthood, when they reinvoked the gods and went to the festivals again, participated in all this mythology, yet you've got to understand that in the minds of these people, what you believed privately about these gods was your own business. There did not have to be in their minds a necessary connection between what you profess to believe and what you really believe. And this was not thought of, now listen to me, this was not thought of as being agnosticism or infidelity. That is, you follow me? If a fellow went to the temple and gave his chicken as a sacrifice on the birthday of his child to a god he thought was a lot of baloney, you know, the god probably didn't exist, then that didn't make any difference. And he was not considered being irreligious. Important thing is, he went through the motions. Sort of a state thing, it was a group thing. Now, that's why, now, this is also a little study of the early Christians. This is why the Romans never could understand the Christians. And this one fact led to much persecution of the Christians. You see, when Rome finally got around to persecuting the church in the late first century into the second century, these Roman governors, for instance, you see that the clearest example, I think, of this is in Pliny's letter to Trajan, which he tells, and also in the letter from Sardis, which tells about the martyrdom of Polycarp. Now the governor would, they get this Polycarp in there, they get these Christians in there, and they would say, want them to make, Caesar is Lord, and Jesus is accursed, or sign a document to that effect, and they go home, and they send them in effect, look, you, and then, but they would say, well, Caesar isn't a Lord, he isn't God. And the governor would say, what's that got to do with it? We know that. I mean, you get Caligula, see, he makes his horse a senator, builds a temple, his horse can be worshipped, and shovels gold dust off the temple palace and makes a big drum, so whenever it thundered, he'd beat the drum to thunder back at Zeus. I mean, you know, he got anybody that suddenly could be, he was so bad, finally the Praetorian Guards finally assassinated him, everybody was glad when they did. You know, the guy would be probated for noon. They caught him out. He's not a son of God. However, he wasn't that much worse than some of the other gods. But that was never the point.
point was, and it, if you go through the public motions of it, you see, what you said publicly had no connection whatever with what you believe privately. And all other peoples in the world would accept that. You come and you know, they would say you give public obeisance to Caesar, and then you go do whatever you want to do. Believe what you want to believe. You don't care. Caesar doesn't care. Nobody cares. But you see, the Christians wouldn't buy that. The Christians were the only ones who said, we cannot profess one thing in public. Our public devotion must be the same thing as our private devotion. Our public profession must be the same as our private faith. And the Romans never did understand that. But not the pagans. Never did get that message.
Was this attitude the same with other countries and their national bodies?
What attitude do you mean?
The attitude that privately they
pretty much. Pretty much. The Jews are the exception. And we saw this back in 165 BC in that period when under the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes and the Seleucid rule. But they were the only exception. Y'all see that? It's the end of religious thinking. There was just no connection. Well, you see, what I'm saying is that this did not go very, this faith, or what we would call religion, did not go very deep. And that's why when Christianity came along, which offered something deep and lasting and moral and intelligent, something, in other words, you might go through the motions on behalf of the state, and you might believe in the gods a little bit. You may believe in them a great deal. But you wouldn't give your life for them. You see, even though this is a belief in the gods, listen to me. It was an acceptance of this mythology and this revival of mythology under Augustus simply because there wasn't anything better. There was not a choosing between respectable alternatives. Now, there were some other things that were chosen. We'll get into that in a few minutes. Into the mystery religion. Did you see this? That is, the people were encouraged in the spirit of a national, of a patriotic renewal. They were encouraged to go back to the worship of the gods, and they did so. But it was very thin, very shallow. There was a lot of skepticism, open skepticism on the aristocrats. You know, it's convenient, therefore let's believe in it. And among the people, there was no, it didn't grab the heart, never ruled the heart. And of course, we would say, well, if it doesn't really rule the heart, is it really religion? But we think of religion in terms of Christianity. It's all or nothing, at least theoretically. As an indication, there's two other things we must talk about before we get to the mystery of religion. One is this, that symptomatic of the embarrassment caused by these gods, these mythological stories, of rape and murder and deceit and thievery, adultery among the gods. There arose a school of thought among the pagans now, and it centered in Alexandria, which was in our period. Alexandria was the educational or intellectual center of the world. The Ptolemies had built their great libraries there. We know of one library that had over 400,000 volumes in it. Later on, this became a center of learning for the Jews, Philo. It became a center of learning for the early church with such scholars as Clement of Alexandria and, of course, the great Origen. Now, there arose a school of thought in Alexandria, Egypt, which dealt with these mythological stories, the old Greco-Roman religious myths, in this way. They tried to make them intellectually respectable. They were obviously irrational, obviously immoral. They did not elevate the person, didn't make any sense, and very often. So, in an attempt to rehabilitate many of the ancient mythological stories, which were full of murder and adultery and all the deceit and betrayal and all these things that I already talked about, they took this approach. They said, look, these stories are not to be taken literally, as if real gods who lived or live really did these things. These are allegories. kind of a souped-up parable. These allegories, these are allegories, therefore, their simple grammatical literal meaning is not to be given any attention. But they are allegorical, they represent something else. And when they got to telling what the allegories meant, then somehow the story they can make by, it's very subjective. If you label something an allegory, but obviously it isn't, then it says the allegory means whatever you want it to mean. And they could use this subjective device to make these stories more respectable. To say, now this story, this was not told as an actual event. This god really did not murder this other god, or attempt to do so, cut it in pieces. This is an allegory. Now, you all see that? For instance, I'll give an example of this. This is a, which might make more sense to you. It's a very convenient way of doing away with the simple meaning of a story or a text of any kind. The example which might be interesting to you is the way that Jehovah's Witnesses deal with Luke chapter 16, the account of the rich man and Lazarus. You remember how the rich man who ignores Lazarus lay at his gate full of sores? And so he dies, and he's in Hades, lifts up his eyes in torment, and he calls the father of Abraham, and you all know the story. But you got a problem, see, that's fine. Is this a parable?
No, it's never presented as a parable.
Is the meaning obvious or almost obvious as in most parables?
No, it just never tells us this is an event.
But you see, if you don't believe that, if you believe in soul sleeping, you don't believe that there's anything in and of man conscious that consciously survives the death of the body, then you've got a problem, because you've got a clear statement in Scripture of a man who died and was still conscious after his death and got thirsty. If you believe this is impossible, then what do? Well, you allegorize it. Or in the case of a Jehovah's Witness, they say, well, this didn't really happen. This is not a literal historical event. This is an allegory. This is a parable. And when they get through telling you what it means, it's kind of like the Baptist dealing with John chapter 3 and the new birth, you know, water and spirit. You get this ingenious, fantastical, imaginative interpretation that nobody in the world would have ever thought of if they hadn't been grinding an axe. That's what you get out. You got that? So this is what they were doing with these systematic. They didn't get very far. There was nobody who had paid much attention except in Alexandria. Because no one cared. The common people, the uneducated masses, they didn't care. All they cared about, you see, life in the ancient world was short and nasty. And very few people, the common people, ever looked much beyond the next meal, the possibility of the next meal. So they didn't care, you know, about these intellectual gymnastics that tried to rehabilitate, as I've said, the mythological stories. But among the scholars, among the Greek-oriented people, which went through the Greeks, there was interest in this, but it's important to us at this point because we understand that people were genuinely trying to come to grips with this vapid, intellectually sterile, immoral system of religion.
Trying to
remodel the thing. And do this by allegorizing. You have any questions on that? You all make sure you understand that. Now, this is important. Any questions? Yes.
All right. So at this period of time, the Roman god that they believed in now was spreading through the empire. Instead of having their own individual gods each place, they were now to have.
Well, these gods from Rome. No, there had been a long process, even before Alexander the Great, of homogenizing this religion. So they, as I said yesterday, they would simply say, well, this god that we have is the same as your god that you had, and they give him the same name. I would give a different name, the same god, different name. They worship this god and this, and we'll worship your god on this side, we call him. So there had been this homogenization of the mythological religion for a long time, 2 or 3 centuries at least. Even before, in some areas of the world. Yeah.
I don't understand why we even bothered to try to allegorize all this.
Well, that's an excellent question, Dave. Why did they bother? The reason they bothered was this, that when you've got nothing, anything looks good. You can understand that, and again, this helps us understand why Christianity took the Roman world in one generation. They took the Roman world in one generation.
Because, you see, people were aware, they were more cosmopolitan. You see, people are people. One of the big mistakes that we make is that we look at ancient history as if it were another world. We often find ourselves thinking that way. These were people, but they really didn't dream the way I dream. They didn't really love their kids the way I love my kids. And they didn't have to worry about taxes the way I do. And when it came to dying, they really didn't have the same fear that I had. Oh no, these are people. One of the things you get from reading ancient literature, how much that it sounds so contemporary. These people, just as we are, they realized that because man is incurably religious, and man is aware of his own immortality, and they were aware that they were.